British Spy Stories, Season 1. Spy or Traitor? Episode 17. Caroline decides to walk the last leg of the journey to the Cabinet Office and takes the tube to Green Park, then cuts down the broad path that runs from Piccadilly to the Mall. She walks fast, not due to any lateness, but because that is what she has always done, going somewhere quickly throughout her life. She walks across St. James's Park and heads for the Park Bridge to cross to the southern side of the water. She thinks about her current case and wonders how likely it is to be successful. The security services are famously reticent when it comes to appearing in court. She knows that from 20 years of hearing Stephen stop mid-sentence when he knows that he has reached the limits of what she can know. She has always told herself that she doesn't mind his secrecy because it's more than a job to him. It's part of his whole being. Without it, he's not the same man. Caroline had known what he did from the outset, and it seemed exciting at first to have a boyfriend with a job that she couldn't talk about. She was very strict with herself for years, but 5 years ago, she told her closest girlfriend on a cold Thursday in February, after Stephen had been particularly annoying and dangled information in front of her, but then said he couldn't go into details. Linny rehearses in her mind what she needs to talk about at the meeting that she is going to. Her client, McAllister, told her in great detail about the work that his staff carried out. But his tone changed when she asked about his sources inside MI6. Not only did he say that he couldn't tell her, but also that the information was not relevant to the case. She had to put it to him that the case against him would stand or fail on the security services confirming what he had told her. Courts are all about evidence. She had underlined that to him. If there's no compelling evidence about something, then it might as well have never happened. It's as simple as that. She reaches the end of the park and turns left along Birdcage Walk. She will push the Cabinet Office for evidence of the information supplied to McAllister. The whole focus of her planned case is the contact called Petrov, and her tactic for today, she has decided, is to ask for an interview with that source first, and if the Cabinet Office refuse, then she will ask for an inquiry, if necessary, through a judicial review. She isn't going to let them get away with ignoring her request. If that means consequences for this Petrov character, as they are involved in something untoward, then so be it. She is sick of the security services hiding behind their anonymity when they overstep the mark and stray into illegal activity. On arrival, Linny is led through a maze of corridors. All civil service buildings have a similar atmosphere, she thinks, as she follows a small man down a long corridor. He stops and opens one of the huge oak doors that mark out each 50 feet along the walls for as far as she can see. They go into a meeting room. It is quiet, as though soundproofed. Dead air, with nowhere to escape to. The man leaves her with a promise of chasing up, and she sits at one end of the table built for 20. Her brain is all ready to go, on the start line. She sits back and pushes one shoe off her heel, enough to give the slightest release of tension and the minutest relaxation of her muscles. The thought scares her, and she sits up, pulls her shoe back on, and pulls her blue suit jacket across her body. She stands and looks out of the window onto Great George Street, and can hear Big Ben chiming the quarter hour from across Parliament Square. Behind her, the door suddenly opens.
Miss Lawton?
He is in his 40s, dark hair, tanned. A nice house in Reigate, she thinks. His face is smooth like his demeanour, and two eyelashes on his right eye are pure white. They shake hands, and he suggests they pull two chairs away from the table, as he is not a great believer in formality.
"How can I help?"
he says, in a way that reminds her of a marketing manager from a mobile phone company. She explains the case that she will be bringing to court in the next fortnight and the need for his help to liaise with the security services. He starts the usual spiel about the importance of anonymity and secrecy for the spooks. Linny tells him that she knows all about that as she married one. He laughs, but not with his soul.
"What do you need?"
he says.
"My client received information from the Secret Intelligence Service," she begins. "It was part of his contract to provide security for them as part of an integrated program of work of 18 months.
"Where was this?"
"Slovenia."
"What was the nature of your client's work?"
"The contract defines it as security services. In practice, he was providing additional manpower for British intelligence."
"Do we know what the manpower actually did?"
He is cool but intense.
"Not spying, if that's what you mean,"
she says, with a slight smile which he returns.
"Personal security guards, mostly. He employs ex-military personnel."
"All vetted, I assume."
"Of course," she says.
"And what about this contact you say he has in the security service?"
"Petrov?" "That's the name he was given."
"I can't confirm if there is someone in either MI5 or the SIS with that name, I'm afraid."
"I understand the policy of denial that security services use," she says. "I don't need to know their real name. I just need a video link interview with me, one-to-one, and a live black screen video feed in the court to give their evidence."
"What is the information that was passed to your client?"
The man is becoming more closed, she perceives.
"Just the detailed operation that his team would need to be involved with."
"You're saying that details of the SIS operations were given to your client?"
he says.
"Yes."
He stops his flow, having got to the end point of whatever process he was following for the discussion. She watches his face as he turns his eyes away, down and to the right.
"I'll have to come back to you,"
he says eventually.
"When?" "The court date is set for the 16th.
"I can't commit to a date. Your timetables may have to change."
She starts to protest, but he holds up his palm. She adds,
"I don't want to go to judicial review,"
and watches his reaction. He flicks his eyes up to meet hers.
"I'm sure that won't be necessary."
He smiles weakly.
"Let me show you out."
The message from Marjorie agreeing to talk comes through in the morning as Gabrielle is driving back from the airport, having dropped off Hans on his way back to Berlin. She hasn't particularly been looking forward to the conversation, as she can't work out a legitimate rationale for Marjorie to be a spike node of activity in Jim's data. She grabs the tablet from her room and books a meeting room at the reception desk of the business suite on the third floor. There are 5 rooms. She has booked a small one and swipes the door access. The room has a table for 6 and is overlit with stark downlighters. There is a large screen at one end. Gabby opens the cupboard that contains all the display equipment and pushes her hand into the cable looms to pull out a fistful of wires. She traces them back to a wall box, finds the network leads, and plugs in her tablet to the network. She runs her porting app to block her location and encrypt the signal, and pushes the tablet into the cupboard so it will sit there and divert the network during the call. Then she selects the video conferencing software on the control panel and calls London. Her friend answers immediately, at first without video switched on, then after the sound of a door closing, Marjorie's face appears. They greet each other and talk inconsequentially for a minute.
"Anyway, how are you?"
says Marjorie.
"Back in Berlin, just planning my next move."
Marjorie's eyes look away from the camera for a second, which tells Gabby that the MI5 network is returning location unknown to the screens in front of Marjorie.
Did you want to chat about something, Gab?
I do. You know we were talking about Stranra?
Your friend who was killed?
Yeah, well, I did some digging and your name came up.
Gabrielle had expected an uneasy silence, but there isn't one.
My name's always coming up,
says Marjorie with a laugh in her voice that seems real.
What particularly? The night before he was killed, after I'd put the location into Oberon, I have a trace of comms activity on the network.
Right.
Two people were particularly active that night and into the next day. One was in Berlin, and the other was you. That happens a lot because my job's to lead live ops in the 5 control, she says. So there are always dozens of messages. They are probably all mapped back to my user ID on the system, as I'm the officer responsible. Was there a live op overnight on that day?
Asks Gabby.
I don't know offhand. I'd need approval to share that with you. Why would the messages be going from 5 control to Berlin? Your ops are all in the UK, surely?
Yes, of course, we're domestic, says Marjorie.
But there are often players involved from outside of the UK. It could be that the embassy in Berlin had an interest in one of our ops, for instance.
Do you know Murphy in Berlin?
Says Gabrielle.
Berlin station chief for 6. I've met him once or twice,
says Marjorie.
Why? Do you think he's involved? I don't know. As the comms have a spike in Berlin too, I thought maybe. Why don't you ask him?
I intend to.
Off the record, Gab,
says Marjorie.
We have no official interest in anything with a German flavour right now.
She is getting somewhere at last.
Can I put words into your mouth?
Says Gabby.
When you say nothing official, that doesn't discount unofficial. I can only confirm our official ops, of course. And those unofficial ops could involve Vauxhall Cross.
I couldn't confirm that,
says Marjorie.
Any guidance on who else wouldn't know about unofficial ops? Ask in Berlin.
Gabby looks at Marjorie on the screen. There is not a flicker of movement in her face.
It's a pity you haven't got any information, then,
says Gabby.
Good to see you, Marge. Loved your mother. Talk soon, Gab.
The woman from MI5 gives the smallest of waves as the video image fades on the television.
Thank you, Marjorie,
says Gabby to herself. She packs up, disconnects the network proxy divert and goes to the restaurant for lunch. She takes a seat by the window overlooking the Promenade des Anglais and studies the menu. After ordering, she thinks about Marjorie and whether her friend had given her anything useful, or was this some sort of trap. Gabby still has a nagging question in her mind about why Marjorie fabricated her father's death. He must have done something that required the need for a J-17 order, the creation of a new fictional life for someone who needs to disappear. But her father wasn't in the service. So did Marjorie do something? It doesn't make sense given the information Gabby has, so her brain moves on to thinking about Riverside. The information he provided wasn't a game changer for her. It told her that there were people talking about Berlin ops on the 6 network, but that's not news. Whenever there is any planning or a live operation, various branches get involved and will message each other. So why did he provide those specific messages to her? In Gabby's view, every single action in the world is motivated by someone getting a benefit. The question here is, who benefits from his actions? Riverside's stated belief in being driven to find the mole seems legitimate, but why come to her? If he has evidence, then the easiest route to find the mole is to just escalate the data. While she is concentrating, she doesn't notice a man come up to her table and takes a second to realize he's talking to her.
Can I help?
She says.
I wanted to ask. I've seen you eating alone a few times. I wanted to know if
if you wanted to have dinner? He's handsome, she thinks, and smiles at him.
I'm fine, thank you.
A drink, then.
Tonight.
What harm could it do? She looks at him. 40s, American. Blue eyes. She considers maintaining her barriers. But then she thinks she might enjoy the company of someone who doesn't want to talk about spying.
Okay, she says.
Great. I'll meet you in the bar at 9.
Sure. I'm Charlotte. What's your name?
James McKinney, he says.